Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, August 19th, 2007, and this is show number 108. Well, we're back from our big excursion to Italy. Did you miss me? I've been playing around with Web Gallery on iPhoto on the new iLife 08, so I put a small set of photos from my trip online at gallery.mac.com/asheridan, if you'd like to see our adventures. I hope it's not like watching a stranger's home movies to look at them, but hey, you can ignore me and not look at them if you want to. From a culture, food, sightseeing perspective, the trip to Italy was just wonderful. From an internet access view, it was a dismal failure. I knew we'd have no access for the first two nights when we were in Cinque Terre, but the next 10 days were secured. I mean, I paid in advance for places that had high-speed wireless broadband. I mean, I did this 5 months in advance, right? So for 7 days, we were in a villa in Tuscany, and it turned out we had no access at all. I know, you're having trouble mustering up a little sympathy for me in the villa in Tuscany plot, right? Well, I do have to say that one of the great joys was jogging in the early morning sun, watching the light change over vineyards, sheep herds, and stone villas on the distant hills. It was kind of weird. I started by listening to a podcast, but it just didn't seem right after a while, so I actually listened to music of all things. Somehow tech podcasts just seemed out of place. That was really, really neat, though. I must say we weren't completely without internet access. We went to visit our daughter, Lindsay, going to school in Siena, and she had high-speed access. So every time we went to see her, we rushed in with all our laptops, soaking up as much wonderful broadband speed as we could in 15-minute chunks. It was like watching heroin addicts mainlining after a week in rehab, and we loved it. I thought you'd enjoy seeing how many laptops we take on vacation, so I took a picture of them all stacked up and put it in the show notes. All right, so now we're done relaxing in Tuscany, and we drove up to Lake Como on the border of Italy and Switzerland. The hotel there also guaranteed broadband, but we had the weirdest experiences with it. The hotel we were staying at was called Silvio's in Bellagio. You can find that at bellagiosilvio.com. And it was full of almost magical innovations. Picture this, a 90-year-old hotel on the shore of this beautiful lake. I bet you didn't picture a magic stairwell where the overhead fluorescent lights come on and a line of LEDs under each marble stair lit up, though, did you? Well, the doors to the rooms are sheer, smooth, highly reflective burgundy wood. Door locks are the best I've ever seen or used. The keys are symmetrical, so you don't have to know how to orient them. And they just slid in smoothly, and the fluorescent lights in the bedrooms were a dream. They had a switch by the door that turns on the overhead light, switches on both sides of the bed to turn off the overhead light, and also to control the bedside lamps. The doors to the balcony rotated like normal doors, but they also pivoted open from the top so you could get air without actually opening the door. At the top of the marble stairs to the lobby, they had a sliding glass door etched with the name of the hotel and an open and closed sliding by on a motion sensor. At dinner, we were seated out on a deck enclosed in glass, but the glass walls were only about half height when we started dinner. As a chill came across the lake, each of the walls raised up about 3 or 4 feet to keep the wind at bay, and later they moved all the way up. Really magical. It was cool. Since we're geeks, of course, we spent the better part of our last evening meal overlooking this amazing scenery, and we spent the most of our time figuring out how the glass walls were operated. There was also a glass elevator where the door opened like a normal door on a hinge. I never did figure out how that worked with the whole up-down thing. Well, I gave you all that detail so you'd get a flavor for how automated and high-tech this hotel was, which makes the internet experience just that much more bizarre. They were using an encryption I hadn't used before, WEP40/128-bit hex. The good news was that they had really good instructions for both Windows and Mac on how to set it up. The problem was that it was really erratic. Steve could almost always get on our room on his PowerBook, and one time I was able to get on our room, but I was kicked off after 10 minutes, never to reconnect again. Ron and Kyle never got on in their room or ours, not even once. But there's Steve happily getting on in his. And of course, we tried sitting where he was sitting and that kind of thing. Nothing worked. All four of us could happily jump on if we were down in the lobby. Needless to say, we went to the lobby a lot. Plus, there was a bar there, and they had cappuccinos in the morning, sodas and wine in the afternoon, so I guess it wasn't all bad. Perhaps I'm obsessing too much on technology, and I'm telling you, it rubs off on my family. My son Kyle may be a little too computer-oriented now. On our vacation, I asked, "Where's my wine?" He said, "Hit Command-F and type in wine, and then right-click and say, show in Finder." Ah, if life were only that easy. Well, it's time for an iPhone Minute. This one is titled, Ever Hopeful. So as you know, Ron and I both got iPhones shortly before our vacation. Just a few days before we left, a horror story was posted online about a guy who used his iPhone for a little bit of surfing, few emails here and there, and a couple of phone calls, all in Europe, and ended up with a $3,000 bill from AT&T. I figured something else was wrong, but I decided to just put mine in airplane mode the whole time so it couldn't possibly hit the network, except when we were in the range of a Wi-Fi network. Ron was bolder and decided he was going to do some experiments. He was bound and determined to find a free Wi-Fi hotspot in Italy. So everywhere we went, Ron would whip out his iPhone and look for hotspots. It got really kind of comical after a while. I finally took a picture of him looking for hotspots. It was especially funny because in 2 solid weeks, from England in the airport, Tuscany, Cinque Terre, Lake Como in Italy, and Lugano, Switzerland, Ron didn't once find a free hotspot. I guess the U.S. is actually a little bit ahead of Europe in that. I should mention that out in the middle of Lake Como on a ferry, though, Ron got 5 bars on the Edge network, and he was never without Edge anywhere we went. So I guess that's kind of a good vote for Edge, isn't it? Well, as I mentioned, I didn't use my iPhone much, so I decided to do an experiment to see how long mine would last on standby. I'd been using it the day we left, and on a few occasions I turned it on when we were at Lindsay's for the Wi-Fi, so I did stack up 3 hours and 13 minutes of usage during this experiment. But get this, it lasted an additional 7 days and 13 hours of standby time. Of course, I took a picture of it, just so you could see that I'm not making this up, and I got that picture just about a half hour before it shut itself down in agony. So I can prove what I'm claiming. I thought this was pretty darn good, and it does validate Apple's claim of 10 days of standby time. So with 3 hours of usage and 7 days, 7.5 days of standby time, I thought that was pretty good. Well, now I'm just going to tell a silly story that doesn't have any technology in it at all, but I think you'll enjoy it. So my buddy Ron has a stuffed penguin named Rico. Remember the animated movie Madagascar? There was a really clever and yet somewhat insane penguin in the movie. Well, his name was Rico. For some reason, Ron brings Rico on all of his vacations, and he likes to take photos of him in humorous situations. We had a lot of fun with Rico in Italy at the vineyards, Rico with all of Lindsay's female roommates. Rico has a way with the ladies, you know. Rico drinking a limoncello and a lot of Chianti. He prefers rum, but he was willing to try new things. When we were staying in Tuscany, we made a day trip to Pisa. You know, it's one of those touristy things you just have to do. Pisa's pretty much the tower, a Duomo, and a baptistry, which was gorgeous, by the way, and then you go home. But Rico insisted on having his picture taken with his flipper nonchalantly resting on the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Ron and I trotted out onto the grass so we could set up the picture. There was a sign clearly saying to keep off the grass, but there were literally hundreds of people out on the grass when we got there. What happened next was hysterical, and lucky for you, Steve just happened to be videotaping us as events unfolded. I put a link to the YouTube video in the show notes so you can enjoy that firsthand. It's humiliating to me and Ron, but I guarantee you're going to enjoy it. Well, let's do a little bit of technology here. Last March, on show number 85, I told you about a cool image viewing application for the Mac called Xee. Remember, this is the one where the developer said he picked the name because of the ambiguity in pronunciation amused him? I did a full review back then, or what I thought was a full review, but while I was on my vacation, I started realizing how much more Xee could do than I ever realized. So let me start from the beginning here. I take about 5,382 pictures per day, if you ask my son, more if I'm on vacation. So I need a good workflow to figure out what to throw away and have a way to easily name all my files, all those other kind of administrative tasks. Well, years ago, I bought iView Media Pro, which at the time, I'm pretty sure I remember it costing around $70. It's a highly capable package with a vast array of functions, but I pretty much use it just for those things I've just described. Over the years, they've come out with several updates, and they've also been purchased by Microsoft, and now it's $100 to upgrade to the latest version. Needless to say, I have not upgraded. One day on the trip, I was going through and renaming my photos in iView Media Pro, and it was kind of slow going, slogging through each photo, because they take a fair amount of time to load in iView. On a lark, I opened up Z instead and told it to look at the folder of photos I wanted to work with. When I had looked at Z before, I thought it was just for viewing photos. But when I started poking around in the menus, I discovered that I could rename them from within Z. Better yet, there was a key combination to bring up the rename option, so I could get going really, really quickly snapping through the photos. I'm telling you, these photos whipped up much faster in Z than they do in iView, so that was a great advantage. Another good thing was that if I moved a photo from one folder to another in the Finder, I didn't have to tell Z that I did it because it's always looking at the file structure as it is at that instant. In iView, I would get broken links if I moved a photo because you kind of pull them in batch and tell them where they are, and if you move them, it gets all confused. Then I discovered a really great feature of Z. Like iView, I had the option to rotate a photo in case it was in portrait instead of landscape. But I did discover that in Z, I had the option to save the photo in the new orientation, and I could save it losslessly. That is, not recompressing it as a new JPEG. I think that's really slick. They have keystrokes for next picture, switching to full screen mode, and also for resizing to fit on screen, which comes in handy with those pesky portrait-oriented photos. As I worked with Z, I realized it did everything I needed iView to do. It did it faster and more easily, and handled my photo needs better than iView. I'm not saying iView isn't a great product, because, like I said, it's got a ton more capability than I ever took advantage of. But for me, Z does exactly what I need. All of this, and it's donationware. Check it out at wakaba.c3.cx/s/app/z.html. And if you just aren't typing that fast, there's a link in the show notes if you didn't catch that. Well, I just realized that you probably have been wondering how we protected our cars from the elements while we are on our trips. You were worried about that, weren't you? With Lindsay in Italy and then Kyle on the trip with us, that meant we had four cars with only two garage spaces. Street sweeping prohibits parking in the street for a week at a time, so that option was out too. We have a driveway that's suitable for parking, but we also have a 70-foot elm tree in the yard. Beautiful tree. And it's a haven for birds, and as you might remember, the occasional raccoon. Parking in the driveway will get you bird poop on your car faster than you can say, bird poop. For normal humans, that would not be a big deal. Just hose off the car when you get back. But for the obsessed like me, that would bother me the whole time I was gone. For Kyle's car, it wouldn't be that bad, I suppose, but Lindsay's car was repainted a few years ago. Remember the holes in the paint story? Anyway, a repainted car is much less forgiving of bird poop than original finishes. In fact, every single bird poop that has hit that car since the day it got repainted has left a permanent mark on the car. No amount of waxing, cling, or polishing will remove those marks. Everyone makes me sad. So what to do about the cars? I have to give Honda Bob credit for the solution. He suggested that we put a coat of wax on the car before we leave, and then the bird poop wouldn't stick. So right before we left, we put wax on both cars all over the top and sides to protect them. Fast forward 2 weeks, and now I have to figure out how to get the stuff off. You might think I could just rub it off since it's wax, but of course it's wax with filth all over it, so I can't rub it in. I also can't wash it off with a sponge and soapy water, because it's wax. Then I decided maybe I could hose off the filth and then rub it out. It worked great. The filth did just slide right off, including the bird poop. So the major goal was achieved. But as some of you have probably figured out by now, that wax is hard on there and not even thinking about rubbing off. Well, here's a little hint. Whenever you have something that won't dissolve, you know that if you use like material, that will get it off. So let's say you have a whiteboard marker mark on your board and you can't clean it off. Well, just write over the spot with a whiteboard marker, and then when you erase it, the spot is gone. Got tar on your feet from the beach and soap won't take it off? Use cooking oil. Breaks it right up. So I used that logic and I simply waxed right on top of the hardened wax. It technically worked, but man, was that tough going. Just about rubbed my right arm off my body. And I've only done Kyle's car so far. I still have Lindsay's to go. But the good news is Honda Bob's idea was right on target. The cars were protected, and now they'll be clean and waxed. Well, speaking of Honda Bob, are you one of the lucky people who drives a Honda or maybe an Acura? I know I'm biased, but I think they're great cars. Not only have they been extremely reliable for me with really, really low repair bills, I get really high resale value out of my cars. I know this isn't a scientific experiment because I've never bought any other kind of car, so we don't know how well I do with that, but there's a reason I don't buy any other kind of car. In 1978, someone turned me on to this great Honda mechanic named Honda Bob, and since he was reliable, trustworthy, and talented, I didn't see why I'd switch car manufacturers because then I'd have to find a new mechanic. Perhaps I get great resale value out of my cars because Honda makes great automobiles. Perhaps it's because I wash and clay and wax them to within an inch of their lives so people buy them just for their looks. But perhaps it's because Honda Bob keeps them running so smoothly and does all the maintenance we need to make them last forever. Who's to say? If you live in the LA area and you're lucky enough to drive a Honda or an Acura, I really think you should consider having Honda Bob drive to your house and do all of your maintenance and the few and far between repairs. Check out his website at hdabob.com or call him on the phone at 562-531-2321. I know this sounds trite, but you'll be glad you did. H.J. Bob's Mobile Service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, I know this has been kind of a technology light show, but since I was only in town a couple of days, I didn't have much time to go around for fun tools to tell you about. I also missed all of the excitement of iLife 08 coming out. But luckily, Bart volunteered to bring us up to date with a review of iLife 08 from his perspective. Here's that review.
Hi folks, this is Bart from bartbuchas.ie back for another review for the NoSillaCast. Today I'm going to give you my initial reaction to the new iLife 08. This isn't particularly a very in-depth review because I've really only had the application a few days, so it's going to take me a couple of weeks until I get absolutely certain about what I want to say. However, I still think I have a few interesting initial thoughts to share with you, so here goes. Actually, before we go any further, I just want to say that I don't actually have a digital video camera or in fact any form of video camera, so I'm not a user of either iMovie or iDVD. So when I'm going to talk about iLife today, I'm going to really concentrate on the two elements which I use an awful lot, which are iPhoto and GarageBand. I'm also not going to talk about iWeb because I believe it's such a fundamentally flawed application that there really isn't anything good I can say about it. If you want to hear all the bad things I can say about it, by all means have a look on my blog at www.bartbuchas.ie/blog. Basically, the only way Apple could possibly fix iWeb would be to take the entire thing, throw it in the bin, and start over again, which they haven't done. They've just tweaked things a little bit in iWeb, so really iWeb is as iWeb was, which, in my opinion, means rubbish. Now, before we get into the two iLife apps that I use extensively and would consider myself to be a power user of, which is iPhoto and GarageBand, I just want to have a quick word about iMovie. Apple have done something very, very strange here. Normally, you start off with a 1.0 product, and then over the years, you slowly increment it, you add in features, you improve things, you tweak it. What you very rarely do is take a mature application, throw it in the bin, and start from scratch again. However, that's exactly what they've done with iMovie. Basically, what they've done is they've recreated an entirely new application with an entirely different focus to the old iMovie and called it iMovie. But just to show you that it really has changed, they've completely changed the logo. Personally, I think they should have simply gotten rid of the name iMovie altogether with this new program because it really is completely new and called it something like Home Movie Maker or something like that. Basically, it's designed at very, very simply and very, very quickly making sort of mashups of your home movies. So you can take clips from everywhere, all your movie files, drag and drop them into a movie, throw in nice transitions, throw in some nice title text, stick in a background track, and publish it to YouTube, all within a couple of minutes. That's what the new iMovie's aimed at. It's really not an editing suite anymore. You lose an awful lot of the power you had in the old iMovie. And Apple seems to recognise that they've done this because the old iMovie is still available for free to people who buy the new iLife. So I suppose we haven't so much lost something there as we've kept the old iMovie stagnant and we have an entirely new application with an entirely new focus which they've confusingly decided to also call iMovie. Anyway, now that I've had my little rant about how terrible iWeb is and my little discussion on the new iMovie, it's time to get into the meat and bones of this review, which are the two iLife applications which I absolutely adore and use an awful, awful lot, and that's iPhoto and GarageBand. So I think we'll start with iPhoto. I was a big fan of the old iPhoto, and I really couldn't see very much room for improvement. However, there were a few things about it that sort of annoyed me a little, and I was absolutely delighted to see that they've actually tackled them all, and they've improved everything. So one of the things that annoyed me the most was that when you go to import something from your camera, it was basically an all-or-nothing thing. So you would borrow someone else's camera because they'd taken a picture for you, you'd plug it in, and if they had 400 pictures on the bloody memory card, you would have no choice but to import the lot, delete 399, and then get the photograph you want. That's really not sensible, and it's even on Windows you don't have that kind of carry-on. It was just a very poor show by Apple, and very uncharacteristic of them, really. But they've addressed this in the simplest possible way. When you go to import now, you see thumbnails of all the pictures on the camera. You either click the All button and just suck the lot in, or you highlight the ones you want and then suck in only the ones you've selected. So that's one real annoyance, completely gone, sorted. The second thing that always annoyed me about iLife was how difficult they made it to manage your keywords. It was just clunky and annoying. Well, they've tweaked the UI a bit and now it's much, much easier to add keywords and to manage your keywords. So yet another thing that they've improved very nicely. Something which iTunes has always gotten me very used to is a really powerful search feature. You know the little search box, you start typing and instantly stuff starts appearing. Well, I always missed that in iPhoto because, you just get so used to it between Spotlight and iTunes that you just kind of expect it to be an all Apple product. And iPhoto just didn't have a good search feature at all. Well, now they do. And they've basically implemented it the same as they have on all their other apps. So a little search field at the bottom, you click on the magnifying glass, you get to choose a couple of different criteria, and then you type in what you want, and hey presto, up come all the appropriate pictures. So again, good job there, Apple. The other thing, I guess, that Apple noticed was that nowadays, people don't just have a few pictures. People tend to have absolute gigabytes upon gigabytes of photographs. I haven't counted the pictures in my library, and I probably should have before recording this, but it suffices to say there's a lot, because they date back as far as the early 90s. Yes, I have a scanner. I've been scanning like mad. So there's an insane amount of images in my photo gallery, and scrolling through them is very difficult. So what they've done now is the old concept of roles are gone, and they've renamed what we used to consider roles as events. And now you have two views of your photos, so you can either see all your photos in the old way, and they're grouped by event, so it looks just like it used to, except a little role icon is gone, and it's replaced by a representative picture for your particular event, as they're now called. But now when you import photographs, they automatically go into events, one event per day, you can then split the events and stuff, and you can view your photographs per event, which basically means that, if you have an average of about 20 or 30 pictures per event, then suddenly the size of your scrolling has been reduced by a factor of 20 or so. And this actually works very well, and they also have a nice feature called skimming, which means that as you move your mouse over the representative picture for a particular event, it cycles through all the pictures in that event within the little thumbnail, which I say it's a nice little feature. So really, in summary, all they've done is neatened up the GUI a bit and just made it easier to manage your photographs. So now let's move on to the new GarageBand. There's a bunch of fancy features that I see absolutely no purpose in because I use GarageBand for one reason and one reason only, and that's recording podcasts and bits and bobs for Alison and a few other people. So there's this magic new feature where you basically get to pretend to be a whole bunch of an orchestra and stuff on a little graphical display. I'm sure it's great for the kids, but I don't see the point of it. But maybe that's because I don't use GarageBand for music. So really, as far as I'm concerned, the big differences in GarageBand are that they've tweaked the GUI a little so it looks that little bit shinier, and they fixed the one thing about GarageBand that used to drive me absolutely bananas. And that was the fact that it was so, so difficult to choose the format in which you exported your podcast. You used to have to go into the preferences and go diving through a couple of different panels until you could finally set the preferences. Then you'd export it, and then if you wanted to export the next thing or something else, you'd have to go right down into those preferences again and change the values and so forth. So it meant that, you know, if you always did it one way apart from this one time you want to do something else, then you'd have to remember to go back in afterwards and put it back to the way you like it. Because otherwise, the next time you do a podcast, lo and behold, it'll be exported with the wrong features. Honestly, it just used to drive me absolutely mad. Well, they fixed that. Now when you click Share, Export, you get a little pop-up, and it shows your default settings pre-picked, but you can basically change the encoding settings on the fly each time you export. Very, very simple change, but the difference it's going to make is that I'm going to swear at my computer an awful lot less. Okay, well, that pretty much brings us to the end of the review. I think we've looked at all the iLife bits as much as I can. So I've told you just how much I hate iWeb and how fundamentally flawed I think it is. I've told you about the dramatic and major changes to iMovie. I've told you that I have absolutely no use for iDVD, so I really can't judge, and I really just can't review it for you, unfortunately. I've told you about how great the new iPhoto is and how much it's improved things, and also how the new GarageBand has been improved. So you might say, hang on a sec, Bart, you're missing one. Isn't iTunes also a part of iLife? And I'd have to say, yeah, I'm sure it is on paper. But when you look at the realities, that's actually not true anymore. iTunes ships for free, it's updated entirely independently of the iLife suite, and really the only thing that makes it be part of iLife is the fact that it has an I in the name. So, until next time, happy computing.
Thanks, Bart. Sometime you should tell us about how you really feel about .Mac. Well, I'm excited about the new iLife. Finally, something Mac-related for us to play with. Enough of this iPhone talk. Oh, wait a minute. I know you care deeply about the iPhone, so it's time for another iPhone Minute. When viewing a website on the iPhone, it initially fills in the screen with the entire website, which is pretty much unreadable because it's so small. If you want to view a column within a website, simply double-click on the column of text and it'll zoom the column up exactly to fit on screen so it's very readable. If you turn the iPhone sideways, it gets even bigger, again filling the screen with that whole column width. Well, I'm bringing this up because if you're a web developer, there's a single meta tag you can put on your website that will ensure that the mobile Safari browser will show as much of your content as possible when the iPhone user double-clicks on a section of text. You see, the iPhone uses a width of 980 pixels as the default to be compatible with a lot of browsers. So if your width is much smaller than that, it could be displaying space with no content, making the text smaller to the iPhone viewer than necessary. At least that's what the folks over at Furbo.org are saying. With Niraj's encouragement, I went ahead and threw the one line of code in, setting the max width to 760 pixels, which happens to be the podfeet.com content width. But I'll be darned if I can tell the difference on the iPhone. I even took photos before and after of my iPhone looking at podfeet.com. Looks exactly the same to me. I tested it at full screen and double-tapped onto the main body of the blog, and I can't see any change. If someone out there knows what I'm missing, I'd be curious to hear. Maybe I put the meta tag in the wrong place or something. I can hear James now. Listen, dork, all you have to do is... Well, Tim Verporten of the Mac ReviewCast gave me a real challenge while I was gone. He had the company Macware send me three pieces of boxed software with no clue if I needed any of these applications. I'm even confused on the company's name. If I do an about on the software application, it says Macware. But if you hit the button to visit the website, it says MacXware. But their logo says Macware. It's kind of funny. I was actually irritated, too, by the fact that I had boxes to open and packaging to deal with. Usually getting real stuff is a good thing, but in the case of software, that just really felt superfluous. Now I got to decide whether to throw it away or keep it. In any case, the three applications that were in the box were WebGhost, which is an anonymizing program, Font Library, which is a program with 100 commercial-ready fonts, and Mac Freelance, which is an invoicing program for use in small business or if you work for yourself. These three products are licensed and installed very differently. WebGhost had a serial number, which is only good for 1 year, but it allows you to use public proxies after that for free. It has to do with a subscription, I'll explain. To install it, you drag it to the Applications folder. Font Library is for commercial use on up to 5 machines, but had no serial number or installer. So I just dragged it to the Applications folder just in case. and Mac Freelance is also a drag to applications application. Well, let's start this off with WebGhost. WebGhost is there to protect your privacy by making you invisible online and cleans your internet tracks. Personally, I don't have a need for this kind of software. I'm not very worried about online privacy. Perhaps I should be, but the reality is that I'm not. And I don't do naughty things online, so I'm not worried about that either. I'll try to give this software a fair shake, but I figured it's important to know where I'm coming from before I get started. The first thing WebGhost does when you launch it is ask for your administrator password, because it's going to change your proxy settings. I wasn't fond of this idea, but I did let it do it. I didn't notice any change in my proxies, though. I'm not sure what it was actually doing. That's just what they said. Next, it announces WebGhost is incompatible with Firefox at this time. In order to use WebGhost proxy protection, use an OS X compliant browser such as Safari, Camino, or OmniWeb. Wonder what that's about. Never heard Firefox called incompatible or, non-standard or uncompliant. Oh well. It seemed happy with Safari. Since I'm not familiar with this kind of tool, I had to resort to the help manual to get started. I know, the horrors. Well, right off, they explain that there's three tabs for how to connect to the internet. Direct connection, public proxy, or WebGhost proxy. Direct connection is essentially like turning WebGhost off, and that's the default, which is why I didn't see any proxy changes when I checked my network connections. Public proxies are open servers throughout the world that will mask your IP address, but the manual says the reliability cannot be guaranteed as they are not managed by WebGhost. Also, they're heavily trafficked while the WebGhost servers are only available to registered WebGhost users. I also learned in reading the manual that public proxies provide varying levels of anonymity, and WebGhost gives you an indication on each server of how well it will protect you. I won't go into all the details, but the ones they rate the best are those that don't send your IP address to the target host and don't let on that you're using a proxy server. In the console view, I clicked on public proxy, and I was given a list of proxies to choose from. They were in Turkey, Oman, Australia, Spain, Hong Kong, and Brazil. The ones in Oman all had 3 stars, the highest rating. As you flip through the different servers, you get a nice icon of the flag of the country you've chosen, along with the IP address, how long a round trip takes, and the port it's going to use. Some of them used port 80, but some used other ports. And I couldn't tell you the significance of that if you held a gun to my head. Well, if you choose to use the WebGhost proxies, they choose one for you that has a good round trip time from wherever you are and will guarantee you anonymity. Again, this service is available for 1 year with your paid subscription, but I couldn't find on their site how much the subscription costs for the second year. It can't be too much, though, since the software, including the 1 year subscription, is only $30 US. There's a section in WebGhost for Safari tools which will clear your history, cache, downloads, and cookies, along with your browsing history, and it will erase Safari's performance-enhancing cache of stored web content. They don't make any claim on how they actually delete these things. Do they use a write-over on your disk of ones and zeros? If they do, why don't they mention that? If it's a normal delete and you're really paranoid about this kind of thing, that wouldn't be worth very much, would it? They might be doing it right, but they just don't say. If you like having your browser experience snappy and responsive, remember that deleting all this history and cache can slow you down when you visit sites you've been to before. As an extra bonus, they have a few toggles that aren't really anonymizer functions, but are kind of nice. Within WebGhost, you can block pop-up windows, disable Java and the dreaded JavaScript, and enable plugins. It seems that WebGhost does what it says it's going to do, and the interface is even simple enough for me. So if you're worried about someone tracking your online activities, you might want to check it out at macxware.com, otherwise known as macware.com. Font Library was the one application in the Macware family that before opening, I knew I could use. Installation was weird, though. When you insert the CD, you see a bunch of folders, but no clear application to install and no directions on where it wanted to live. You have folders for categories, fonts, and OpenType, along with what looks to be an application called Mac Font Manager. I think Macware, or is it MacXware, needs to get its act together on naming conventions, I don't know whether to call this Font Library or Mac Font Manager. They used both names. I should tell you the software retails for $60 US. I opened Mac Font Manager, or is it Font Library, and it has two basic panes. The left pane shows fonts available for installation, while the right pane shows those fonts you already have installed. But there's nothing showing as available to install. Okay, so there's an open button at the top, and it lets you choose a folder of fonts. Except when I navigated to the folder for categorized, which the documentation explains helpfully piles the 100 font families into four categories, classic, creative, designer, and refined. I drove over to that categorized folder, and picking any of those categories, or even the whole categorized folder, yielded no joy. No fonts loaded in the left pane. If instead I navigated to the fonts folder, which was one huge pile of 610 fonts, the 100 shown in all the different options like bold, italic, condense, etc., it now shows them all piled up in the left pane. I don't get why they went to all the trouble of categorizing them if I can't view them that way. The nice thing is that as you click on each of the fonts in the left pane, you can see down at the bottom how it's going to look and see it in different sizes, colors, and formats. That was nice. I tried opening the open type folder too, but again, it did not show me what I could install. Which makes me think this folder is just pointing to fonts in the big font library. I don't know. I didn't get it. I don't understand the other buttons either. There's a blue cross that says activate under it, but nothing happened when I clicked it. I then realized that I had no font selected, so I selected Amaretto Thin Normal and then clicked Activate. It came up with a window saying that the font Amaretto Thin Normal has already been temporarily activated and is available in all applications until I log out and restart. So I'm guessing that maybe activating a font is a way of using it temporarily, but not installing it so as to fill up your disk with fonts you only want for a short while. I'm guessing here, but they don't give me more hints than that. I guess install means to really install, but then there's a button that says install at dot dot dot. And if you click that, they ask you for a folder. Now, why would I want to install software near a font somewhere other than where fonts belong? I guess I should say that Mac Font Manager, or is it Font Library, comes with a nice little book with the same sentence printed over and over and over again in each of the fonts, which is a really effective way of viewing the fonts to see which ones you like. I'm not a big font fanatic, and the use of this tool seems pretty clumsy, but many of the fonts were quite lovely, so I guess I'd give it a mediocre rating if I could just figure out what it's called. The final package in the box was for Mac Freelance, which is software designed to allow you to manage your own business. They say you can spend less time on paperwork if you use Mac Freelance, because you can easily add new clients, monitor time spent on projects, track mileage and payments, use international formatting, generate reports for record keeping, and more. It could be argued that I'm unqualified to view this kind of software, simply because I've never had a client or billed an hour in my life. That's not going to stop me from jumping into it. Who knows, maybe someday I'll have a skill someone wants and to pay me for, and I'll need Mac Freelance. Mac Freelance opens with an upper and lower pane on the left-hand side, and the upper one is to show your clients. The lower pane is to show your projects. Let's explore clients first. There's an obvious button to add more clients, and the window that opens allows you to enter all the relevant personal and company information, either by hand or by pulling from your Apple address book. Pretty slick. Also in this client setup screen, you can enter information about invoicing by client. You know, things like client ID, when payments are due, how far is it to their office, you need that for mileage, and what form of currency to use with them. You can even give them a discount through this window. If you're a real entrepreneur and have several companies, you can set up which of your companies can bill this customer. I guess some companies can only bill some customers. How would I know? All right, now we want to charge something out to this customer. There's a big button that says charges, and when you select that, it opens up a pane that allows you to define a task, set it to a fixed or a timed expense, and to set your hourly rate. You can apply a markup fee. Maybe you want to do that to counteract the discount you gave them earlier. There are some fields to apply taxes, but they were grayed out, so I'm not sure how you would get to those. Under Projects, there are buttons that let you add or delete new projects. Clicking Add gives a simple interface below to enter the name of the project, assign an invoice number, set the status to open, build, paid, closed, or voided. I played around with adding a task within a project. I named the project Website Design Project. I was able to then add 4 tasks and set different hourly rates for the tasks. I entered how long each task took, and it calculated the balance for each task. I also noticed that if you have a task selected, you can click a button to start a timer for that task. You can stop and pause, and then the time field is updated with the time you spent on the task. Nice feature. Could really help, integrate the workflow while you're working on a project. I got kind of confused when I tried to create an invoice, even though I had billed thousands of dollars to the task entry field. Previewing the invoice kept showing a balance of $0. Turned out I'd checked some boxes that said EXP next to each task, which I thought meant expense, but evidently it stood for don't bill anyone for this. Well, once I unchecked those little boxes, I had a nice little invoice for $3,800. I hope I get paid soon. Mac Freelance also includes methods for recording payments, tracking invoices, and an invoice book, and allows you to print or email your invoices to your customers. I'm sure there are a lot more under the hood on Mac Freelance, but from a complete novice's point of view, this application seems to have a lot of flexibility, is very easy to follow, and has a delightfully clean interface. For only $40 US, I think this is the best of the 3 applications for Macware that I investigated, and it had the additional advantage of only calling itself by one name. Anyway, you can check out all of these applications, Font Library, WebGhost, and Mac Freelance, along with a whole host of other applications at macxware.com. Well, a while ago I told you that friend of the show Ben McRedman and I were working on the idea of a live version of the NoSilicast. He's built an interesting site integrating live video streaming from Stickum, IRC so that you can write to me while I'm on the air, and then the audio will actually stream into your iTunes or VLC client. It's sort of weird that these 3 things are kind of going on separately, but once you hit all the buttons on the website that he's built, I think it'll work. You can see a preview of what it's going to look like at live.podfeet.com. When I'm not on the air, it's not very interesting there, but you can also, you can go check it out. Well, this will be most interesting if I'm do some interviews. So for our first show, we're going to have an interview with none other than Honda Bob. It was actually a listener request, and I think you'll enjoy hearing him talk on the show how he uses technology in his business, because he is a geek, let me tell you. And maybe we'll even get him to tell one of his famous stories. Oh man, I shouldn't encourage him when he gets going. Anyway, well, we're shooting for somewhere around noon Pacific Standard Time, that's GMT minus 8, on some Sunday coming up soon. We were trying for next weekend, but Ben's going to be in England. The following weekend was looking good, but I think I'm going to be out of town too. We're trying to figure it out. I tell you what, keep an eye on the website, and about 2 weeks, I'll be sure to post the time and date when we pick a good date. I'll, of course, announce it on the podcast, but I was thinking that since podcasts get listened to at any old time, I thought it would be good to give you some fair warning. In any case, of course, the entire interview will be made into a podcast. Well, I think it's time to ring off for the week. It sure is nice to be back and nice to be on the internet again. Remember to send emails with comments, suggestions, and even corrections to allison@podfeet.com or send audio comments to nosilicast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.